As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. A string of incidents on New York's subway has sparked a serious response. Hundreds of soldiers are now on the network helping cops. We ask whether that will help matters and whether such heavy-handed tactics might spread to other cities. And for most people, tinnitus, that ringing sound in the ears, is a temporary annoyance. For others, it's a life sentence. We hear a story of longing for what the affliction takes away, the sound of nothing at all. First up, though.
Today. 是香港的歷史時刻,是香港等待了26年8個月。
John Lee, the leader of Hong Kong, referred to a historic moment yesterday. A moment, he said, that had been more than 26 years in the making. He was referring to a sweeping national security law that passed in the legislature. Hong Kong's mini-constitution includes Article 23, which says the territory must pass laws to prevent treason, sedition, foreign meddling. But Hong Kongers haven't liked the look of proposed Article 23 legislation. In 2003, one attempt led to street protests. Big ones. Times change. A national security law imposed by the mainland government in 2020 led to the closure of news outlets, the arrests of pro-democracy types, greater capture of the whole legislative process. So the new homegrown law sailed through, fast, with no opposition. Its stated aim is to crack down on foreign influence, a frequent boogeyman for the territory's officials. But it'll do much to quieten or to silence Hong Kongers themselves.
Article 23 was introduced really to crack down on dissent and, in particular, to crush ideas of freedom and democracy that had been brewing within Hong Kong for some time.
Bill Ridgers is our Asia Digital editor.
The public in Hong Kong have already been quite cowed by legislation which was brought in by Beijing, but this is just going to make Hong Kongers even more wary of speaking out.
So let's go through it. What is actually in this legislation? What will Article 23 actually do?
So I think the first thing to point out is that Hong Kong already has a national security law. In 2020, following the protests the previous year, the central government in Beijing introduced a quite stinging and strict national security law, which really has cowed the population. But it was actually always in Hong Kong's constitution. It was part of the handover agreement between China and the UK back in 1997 that Hong Kong would have to implement its own national security law. The Hong Kong government says that the current law will in effect be a complement to the one that's been imposed by Beijing. And so to this end, it stacks offences under five main categories of treason, insurrection, sabotage, external interference, and espionage. The law as it stands, I think, has two particularly worrying elements. The first is the extension of power that it grants to both the police and to the government. Anybody accused of breaking this new law can now be denied access to a lawyer. They could have their detention extended by 14 days. Currently, they're allowed to be detained for 48 hours. And equally worrying, there will also be more crimes that are eligible to be held in front of national security judges who are handpicked by Hong Kong's leader, John Lee, and they're picked because they're overwhelmingly pro-Beijing and loyal to the government, rather than in front of a jury, as was the case before.
And all of this amping up over the 2020 version of the law is to tackle the perception that foreign influence is really Hong Kong's biggest problem.
Yes, that view really now seems to pervade the government in Hong Kong and in Beijing, in fact. So the law is really focused quite heavily, I think, on keeping foreign elements in check. And there's already been rumours that NGOs like Amnesty and Greenpeace will be among those designated as national security threats. Now, Mr. Lee thinks that shadowy foreign forces lurk behind locals' disquiet, that they are driving much of the discontent. In particular, he believes that outsiders drove the huge pro-democracy protests that roiled Hong Kong in 2019. Now, I think that's quite a leap of faith. I mean, by some estimates, 2 million people out of a population of 7.5 million went out onto the streets of their own volition to demand freedom to run their city. The equivalent for that would be 90 million Americans marching on Washington. And it strikes me as unlikely that that sort of support could be drummed up by shadowy outsiders.
And you mentioned the protests in 2019, 2020. That wasn't the only time in recent history that people have hit Hong Kong streets when Beijing tried to impose more restrictive legislation. What do you reckon? Could that happen again this time?
No. So I think a popular uprising is unthinkable this time around. As you say, Hong Kong has a long history of protests, from the 2003 protests against the original attempted introduction of Article 23. There were so-called umbrella protests in 2014 and, of course, the huge protests in 2019. But following those protests in 2019 and the introduction of the Beijing national security law, scores of opposition politicians were locked up. Anybody showing any dissent was thrown into jail. And the territory has now been more or less completely cowed. And I think it would be a very brave person now who put their head above the parapet and took to the streets in protest at this law, even though my suspicion is that actually very few Hong Kongers want it.
So if this has essentially been passed and will receive no dissent, what do you see its effects being in a place where dissent was already pretty quiet?
Well, I think there is some concern that the squeeze is going to get even tighter. And I think one good example of that might be on freedom of the press. Now, under the existing legislation, all of the local press that had any pro-democracy or anti-government stance has essentially been closed down. Quite a few of the journalists have been chucked in prison. But at the same time, the foreign press has been able to operate relatively freely. But there is concern amongst the foreign press here that actually these laws, such as espionage, are going to lead to actually a tightening of control. There's several big Western media outlets, including The Economist, have voiced concern that important journalistic work, like investigating government malpractice, could, in essence, be criminalised. And it actually goes further than that, is because Article 23 is extraterritorial. So that means that it can be applied to any person of any nationality in any country. So if you're sitting in London and you are, let's say, calling for Hong Kong independence, you are technically breaching this law and potentially could be arrested if you ever came to Hong Kong. And that puts even more pressure on NGOs or the foreign press who might even want to introduce activists who fled Hong Kong and run stories about them, because that actually could be in breach of the Article 23.
And aside from its own residents and the press who are reporting on the territory, what does this all mean for Hong Kong, do you think? As these laws have tightened the grip that Beijing has on Hong Kong, the discussion has always turned to its role as financial center, as gateway to the mainland. How do things look now on that score?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that actually the protests in 2019 and before that didn't really do Hong Kong, the financial and business centre, very much good, because no business wants to be in a place where millions of people are on the streets protesting, sometimes violently. But I do think Hong Kong has to be careful. Businesses really value things like the rule of law. and they want a consistent judicial system. They also need to be sure that their employees, their executives, aren't going to inadvertently fall foul of Article 23 by making forecasts that the government doesn't like or in any way sort of denigrating Hong Kong. And of course, there's a cumulative effect of images being beamed around the world on news programs and newspapers that suggest that Hong Kong has become a repressive state. So, you know, in the long run, this can only really harm Hong Kong.
Thanks very much for your time, Bill.
Thank you, Jason.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The sounds, the sights, the smells of New York City's subway. Last week, one of the sights was more than a little unnerving. Armed troops at stations across the network, helping police to conduct bag searches. These members of the National Guard, a kind of mostly part-time military reserve, hadn't been deployed in response to some emergency or threat. They were just there in the interests of safety.
Overall, violent crime is down in New York City, but crime on the subway, which is mainly thefts, was up 47% in January, year on year.
Rosemary Ward is our New York correspondent.
And the vast majority of the users, some 4 million people, travel safely. They get home, they get to work, totally fine. But that big increase in January, coupled with some high-profile attacks causing alarm, not to mention, it's very evident that there's a lot of people on the subway who are in the middle of a mental health crisis and or homeless. A lot of people are feeling concerned.
Concerned enough to see to it that there are soldiers on the subway trains?
Well, according to New York's governor, Kathy Hochul, yes.
This has to end. New Yorkers deserve no less. And to those who are feeling anxious whenever they walk through those turnstiles, we will stop at nothing to keep you safe.
The subway, people think of it as such a New York City entity, but it's actually part of a state agency. So it's under the governor's jurisdiction. But up to now, crime and safety has been the responsibility of the mayor. And Eric Adams, the city's mayor, recently deployed 1,000 extra cops onto the subway, and it had success. February crime went down. But these high profile incidents, like a conductor's throat getting slashed, a woman being pushed onto the tracks and then losing her legs when a train ran over her, a man was shot and killed and 4 others hurt in a Bronx station, people feel uneasy. So Governor Hochul decided she needed to do something, and police may not have been enough in her mind. Among other measures, she has put 750 National Guard soldiers at subway stations to assist the police who are checking bags at the turnstiles. She's also deployed 250 state police, but the National Guard is what everyone's up in arms about.
What do you mean by that? How has their presence gone down?
People are not happy. The city has, sadly, a history of racial profiling and stop and frisk, so that's in people's minds. Also, when you see someone in camouflage as you're trying to get to work, it doesn't really sit well. So there's been immediate backlash from the union of transit workers. They had asked for more state police on the subway, and instead they got soldiers who aren't even trained to deal with crime. The police aren't happy either. The chief of patrol at the NYPD tweeted, "Our transit system is not a war zone." And then you have people worried about potential civil rights violations. So there's a lot of people not thrilled.
Well, what about your take? You're a resident, a user of these services. Is this the right way to go?
Honestly, not at all. The National Guard is a state-based military unit, and they're brought in for emergencies. Like if there's a flood or a hurricane, they're the people you want filling sandbags or digging out snow in a blizzard. And during COVID, they helped test for the disease. They're not even allowed to arrest, though they can assist, but I'm not quite sure what they're doing other than just a show of force. And those optics aren't good. And As one person I interviewed said, who represents a riders advocacy group, it looks like we're losing a battle when we're actually doing well in fighting that crime battle. New York City is one of the safest cities in America, and I think people need to be reminded of that. Bad stuff does happen. But what they're doing, having police check bags at the turnstiles and having the soldiers nearby, none of that would have stopped the crimes I just talked about, which happened on the platforms or on the trains themselves.
But for the moment, it seems that New York has these National Guard troops. Do you think they're there to stay, or is the backlash against this going to have an effect? How's this going to play out?
Well, so far, the governor's standing firm. She has dialed back a little bit. The soldiers no longer have those frightening long rifles. But by their very nature, the National Guard can't be a permanent solution. But Governor Hochul has started a movement of sorts. The transit unions in Chicago and Philadelphia, both of which have seen increases in crime, have asked their governors to deploy the National Guard. And so far, the local politicians aren't on board, but it is a tool that they may consider down the road. And soldiers on subways doesn't stop crime. What does stop crime are cops moving along the platforms and the trains and not congregating with soldiers at the turnstiles checking bags.
Rosemary, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Jason.
Some years ago now, I learned to love the rain.
Sarah Wadling writes for our sister publication, 1843, our home for long-form personal stories.
I was in my mid-20s and had recently noticed a ringing in my left ear, and I was not in a good way. I remember not sleeping for nights on end. I remember thinking I would lose my mind. The ringing sound you're hearing now is an approximation of what I hear every day. But it's not exact. I have a hard time describing the sound I hear, mostly because I try not to listen to it too closely. But it's a bit like the static you would hear if you left an old TV on standby, a kind of high-pitched whistle. Heavy rain was a comfort that came at the sole discretion of the universe. So, at the beginning, I took long, long showers to try and drown out this new noise. Certain things in my life became beloved, and they still are. Fridges. The dishwasher. The central heating with its clicks and muted roar, which sounds exactly like a surge of warmth. A YouTube video called Airplane White Noise. I love them for their unassuming and unvarying drone, for the way they shore up my sanity and mask the torment my own mind has devised for me. Tinnitus is far more common than you'd think. This perception of sounds that have no external sources is experienced by an estimated 740 million adults across the globe. For some of them, it's a minor thing, but for others, I think the effects are more serious. Studies have found that between 10 and 20% of Americans with tinnitus experience symptoms that severely reduce their quality of life. One in five respondents to a recent survey by Tinnitus UK, a charity that offers support to sufferers, reported thoughts of suicide and self-harm. My own tinnitus is now more manageable than it used to be. It's kind of been reduced to a gremlin that waits for company, one that welcomes night when all my other troubles muster, and then provides a soundtrack for the gathering. Knowing that loud noise will exacerbate it has increased my sensitivity to sound. My social life became a balance sheet of risk-reward assessments, because you never know when you might be seated under a speaker in a restaurant. Yet for all that tinnitus has fueled my allergy to noise, it also wrecks the quiet. Disturbed sleep, for example, is a common complaint of tinnitus sufferers, perhaps exactly because silence provides an opening, an opportunity for it to achieve supremacy. On bad nights, I dwell within this misfunction of my brain, honing in and in and in on the ringing, until that is all there is. At my first audiology appointment, all those years ago, tinnitus was described to me as typically a response to hearing loss, the brain's uncharacteristically inelegant attempt to replace a frequency it's perceived as missing. But ear infections and blockages from earwax can temporarily cause the problem, and it has been linked to long COVID, to diabetes, and Meniere's disease, which is a rare disorder affecting the inner ear. There is an acknowledged connection to depression, too, but it's not clear whether this is because prolonged tinnitus causes depression or because depressed people are more vulnerable to it. Despite the various theories about the causes, there is no known cure. Even the actual sounds, as I mentioned earlier, are difficult to pin down, since by its nature, tinnitus defies any objective categorization. Using sound therapy to mask tinnitus can ease your mind's grip on an unwelcome noise. And similarly, cognitive behavioural therapy, which is more commonly used to treat anxiety, has been shown to have positive effects by helping to reduce the stress reaction provoked by tinnitus, which then makes it less intrusive. Like anxiety, problematic tinnitus comes with the unwilled vigilance of a mind that cannot find its quiet. Lying awake at night listening to my brain ringing can seem a lot like hearing an audible jangling of my nerves or my thoughts going into overdrive. But tinnitus also makes it harder to listen to your own thoughts. Focusing is difficult when there's ringing in your ears, but so is the generative act of letting your mind wander, since the sound always calls you back to attention. When writing, for instance, the best way for me to catch hold of an idea is to take my time, to tempt it out by falling still and quiet, as one might tempt a wild thing. Yet silence was never only about work. For me, it was a respite, a place of ultimate privacy where I could get away from myself as much as from others. The constant presence of tinnitus threatened to make my own self inescapable. What we mean by silence is usually an environment that allows us to hear, to attend selectively to whatever quiet means to us. The birds chirping in the garden, for instance, rather than the lawnmower next door. Or to our own thoughts. The screech of a tube train as it picks up speed still verges on unbearable for me. But I do get that new pleasure from the rain. I have woken to a summer thunderstorm, and its tinny patter on our skylight offered not just relief from days of heat, but also from the barrage of my tinnitus as I spent another day trying to write about it. I have sat at my desk listening to the downpour, rain that sounded so regular and unhurried that it could last forever. I've come to think that each person possesses their own personal silence, formed by their own particular environment and history, a space that puts our minds at ease. I personally lived in a quiet place as a child, but at night I listened to the sound of my mother typing as she started work after I'd gone to bed. That low tapping became my night quiet, the sound of sleep approaching, proof that my mother was nearby. The ringing now sounds a lot to me like my brain's declaration that it will rattle on as loudly as it pleases, and we have had to, and will go on having to, find an accommodation with each other.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Have I mentioned our survey? We're just constantly trying to improve over here and want to know what you reckon, particularly if you listen to us here on The Intelligence, but you're not yet a subscriber to our new premium service, Economist Podcasts Plus. Do me a little favor and click the link in the show notes, answer a few questions, help us make this whole operation better. Thanks, and see you back here tomorrow.
world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream. But what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.